Nemoto presents scientific giants. Charles Darwin, father of natural selection and evolution. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 33 minutes. You're listening to scientific giants who changed our understanding of the world we live in. Each episode stands beside one mind and follows a thread of curiosity until it ties to the world we inhabit. Today we push open the door of a quiet house in Kent and step into a study where the drawers have labels and the labels are promises. Barnacles, bees, seed dispersal, pigeon skulls, earthworms, questionnaires from far-flung correspondents bound with red tape. The room smells of paper, camphor, and the faint sourness of spirits used to preserve delicate things. On a table lies a sheaf of pages tied with string and weighted with a stone. On the wall hangs a map with a penciled track looping from Plymouth to Brazil to Tierra del Fuego, up the spine of the Andes and out among islands whose names schoolchildren will learn because a man stood there with a notebook and noticed differences. A bell pull hangs near the fireplace for a wife who will come when nausea pins him to the sofa. A small boy's chair sits under a window because science here was a family trade of looking. The man is Charles Darwin. He'll take a pattern scene in a pigeon loft, a sheepfold, a titipool, a forest's edge where seeds hitch rides on burrs, and he will marry it to a pattern scene in ledgers and parish records and shipping manifests and voyages. He will give us a way to think about time that makes the present look like a cliff face spalling into the sea, always losing, always making room for new shapes. He will write a book that calls itself One Long Argument, and he will spend years collecting small facts that do not look like a revolution until they accrete into one. Begin not with a ship, but with a boy who did not look like an argument with a century. He is born in 1809 in Shrewsbury, the son of a physician of size and cunning who believed in money as a solvent for many problems, and the grandson of Erasmus Darwin, a doctor and poet whose verse about nature's mutability made some neighbors consider the family impious. His mother dies when he is 8. His sisters and servants keep his days regular. He collects beetles with an appetite that embarrasses and delights his elders. He makes small explosions. He takes notes. He is sent to Edinburgh to learn medicine and finds, in the theater of the operating room, that his stomach will not stand the state of the art. He learns instead from men who dredge the Firth of Forth and lecture about natural history outside formal halls. He watches a taxidermist stuff birds with arsenic and skill. He learns to look closely at small parts. He hates lectures that ask him to recite back what a man has read in another language. He leaves for Cambridge to study for the clergy because the family needs a plan, and he finds in the Reverend John Stevens Henslow a friend whose version of piety can sit comfortably with a plant's habit of flowering as the day length changes. Henslow teaches him to use a lens and to walk slowly, to treat a hedgerow as a library. Adam Sedgwick, geologist and gentleman, takes him on a field outing to Wales and teaches him to read rocks as frozen accidents that carry their own dates if you can decipher their grammar. William Paley's book on natural theology pleases him with its clean arguments about contrivances and ends, the way a watch seems to demand a watchmaker. He does not forget that pleasure. The arguments will grow faint in a different light, but never become foolish in memory. He learns to ride and to shoot respectably. He learns the tempo of rooms where an Anglican clergyman would be at ease. He is 22 when Henslow receives a letter about a voyage, and Henslow thinks of the former medical student who knows Latin names for beetles and has learned to carry himself without offense in polite company. The letter comes from Captain Robert Fitzroy, commander of HMS Beagle, bound on a surveying mission to chart coastlines in South America and the Pacific. The ship is small, the mission large. Long periods at sea will threaten the captain with gloom that an intelligent guest might lighten. The naturalist meant for the voyage has backed out. Would Henslow recommend a gentleman who can help with the instruments and not disgrace England at a governor's table? Darwin's father calls the plan foolish. His sisters are anxious. An uncle intervenes with cunning and affection, and the father relents. It is late 1831 when the Beagle leaves. The voyage will last nearly 5 years. People play with the dates and the places as if the outcome were inevitable. It was not. Seas are sickening. A small cabin turns a young man green and keeps him there. The captain's temper can go tight as a line. Time ashore is often stolen from the ship's needs. But the world is patient with those who stay on their feet and look. He sees in the layers of rock near Bahia Blanca fossils of creatures he cannot place. Huge bones embedded in sandstone that suggest a ground sloth as big as a cart. They look recent and ancient at once. He sees in these fossils a rhyme with living forms, not a repetition. He reads Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology like a man reading a map for the first time. A uniform world working by small causes over long ages, rivers carving valleys grain by grain, coastal uplift making a city's shoreline older than a citizen's memory. Lyell writes against catastrophes and for patience. Darwin, walking beaches where shells ride high above the waves, sees lines of pebbles and shells on terraces and feels the planet move slowly with the steadiness of a clerk's hand. In South America, he watches men. He watches slavery. He watches gauchos ride with a competence the English romanticize and misunderstand. In Brazil, he writes in his diary about the cruelty scene and vows he will never understand how Christians make peace with it. The vow will sit under sentences late in his life, like a river under ice. He sees the Fuegians, Yagan people, brought to England by an earlier Beagle voyage and now returned. He watches them build boats and live in weather that kills. He listens to Fitzroy's project of moral improvement and the lives that resist being improved. He learns that human variety is not a costume, but a range of adaptations to circumstances. He collects a fox on the Falklands, a rhea in Patagonia, a dozen of this and a dozen of that because variety needs numbers to be visible as law. He meets earthquakes in Concepcion and watches the sea rush out and return. He notes the timing of aftershocks and the expressions on faces around him. There is geology, and then there is the psychology of the earth when it shrugs. He climbs into the Andes and sees seashells high above clouds. He sees strata tilted and folded. He writes about a world that has been lifted slowly, not smashed in a day. In the Pacific, he steps onto coral atolls and writes down a theory that even he seems surprised to love for its economy. Reefs build upward as volcanoes sink. Fringing reefs become barrier reefs become atolls as the mountain subsides and corals keep pace with their own deaths, building on their skeletons toward light. The theory uses Lyell's patience and a diver's geometry. It says that small things transacting their small business can produce structures a fleet must sail around. Admirals, later, test the soundings and find the deep promised by the model. He has earned a little faith that the world prefers consistency to story. In the Galapagos, he walks among iguanas that swim and ones that do not. He notes tortoises with shells shaped in ways he will later call saddlebacked or domed. He puts mockingbirds into his bag and does not yet know he should mark their islands more carefully. He collects finches whose beaks will become a symbol larger than their bodies. The essential thing is not that he recognizes a mechanism on the spot. It is that he sees differences between close neighbors and begins to suspect that closeness in space may rhyme with closeness in lineage. He sees distribution patterns that make sense if species arise and diversify in place, if islands carry their own inventions whose ancestry is on the nearest continent. He sends boxes back to England and promises to make sense of them later. He becomes a node in a network of letters, crates, customs officials, and patient friends who like to open packages and guess. By the time he returns to England in 1836, he is a chest of specimens, a stomach that fears gatherings, and a mind that has learned not to flinch when the world refuses to reassure. He is 27 and looks older. He opens Notebook B. He will have a series, each with a letter, and writes sentences that ask new permissions of a century. One species does change into another. I think. He sketches a tree, a trunk splitting into branches that split and die back and split again, and he puts small words beside the lines. Might probably, I suppose. He marries Emma Wedgwood, his first cousin, who plays piano and reads novels and thinks him dear and wants him to be careful with the faith that has made her life kind. They move to Down House in Kent, a place near enough to London to send letters and far enough to protect a delicate body and delicate pride. He builds a sand walk, a path around a meadow, to walk and think while children hide behind trees and jump out. He keeps to a routine of work and rest, nausea and letters, kindness and notebooks. The theory has a long gestation because he is more careful than is fashionable to be in a story about greatness. He reads Malthus on population and hears the iron sentence that when resources grow arithmetically and mouths geometrically, checks will come, famine, disease, war, and he translates that severity into a more general grammar. Many are born who cannot possibly survive and reproduce. Variation is constant and often inherited. If some variants are slightly better suited to local circumstances, their bearers will leave more offspring. Over many generations, these small advantages accumulate and shape the lineage. A mechanism appears not as a thunderclap, but like a balance being zeroed. At last the beam settles, and you can read. He recognizes that breeders of pigeons, dogs, cattle have been doing a noisy version of this for centuries, selecting by eye and hand, exaggerating traits until a skull looks like a caricature. If a breeder can draw a creature in a decade, what might local soils, predators, winters, parasites, and habits draw in a million years? Artificial selection becomes a parable for natural selection. He keeps notebooks on sexual selection, the peacock's tail as not a survival adornment, but a courtship advertisement, and notes that the females of many species do not choose randomly. Choice exerts a pressure as real as hunger or frost. He wonders about instincts and builds a book in his mind that will eventually have too many chapters. He writes to Asa Gray in America and Joseph Dalton Hooker in Britain and persuades them to read carefully and not tell anyone until he is ready. He likes friends who can be trusted with a thought that might die if exposed to sunlight too early. He becomes a barnacle expert for 8 years because he wants to show that he can be patient with a small creature's life cycle and anatomy before he presumes to talk about species in the grand. He understands that authority in science is built from the bottom up. Show expertise in the parts before you propose a law about the whole. He works in the morning until his body refuses. He lies down with a towel on his head. He writes letters. He returns to the table. He calls the book he is writing a long argument because he is honest about the method. He stacks lines of evidence the way a mason stacks stones when he knows a wall must stand in bad weather, geographical distribution, the fit of organisms to their niches without a presumption of perfection, the imperfections of the geological record, the succession of forms in strata, homologies in limb structure that make no sense if each creature is separately contrived, embryological similarities that suggest a common draft, the success of artificial selection, the failure of supposed barriers between species to prevent forms from blending where geography allows neighbors to meet. He knows the fossil record looks too thin to comfort a system that needs countless intermediates. He says so and argues that geology is sloppy in what it preserves and parochial in where we have looked. He knows the eye frightens friends who want to say that a camera in flesh cannot possibly be produced by tiny intervals. He writes a long paragraph where he says his own thought can hardly follow the steps. Then he takes the steps anyway. Start with a patch of light-sensitive skin. Add a shallow cup to provide direction. Deepen the cup. Add a lens. Wait for the nerve to refine its language. He refuses to pretend that every trajectory is smooth. He insists that it is not impossible for many small changes to walk near miracle. He rejects the claim that the world must be either designed wholesale or abandoned to chaos. He offers a third, lawful process, selection without foresight producing the appearance of purpose, without a planner standing over the scene. He does not rush to publish. He writes abstracts for friends. He drafts outlines. He sorts boxes. He worries about the public harm of premature argument if his evidence is not robust. He sends chapters to readers whose job is to attack. And then a letter arrives from a far archipelago, written by a man he has been corresponding with about bugs and birds and pains in the jungle. Alfred Russel Wallace, ill with fever on Ternate, has had a thought while reading Malthus and sends Darwin a manuscript that contains the core of Darwin's long argument in a few pages. The moment is awkward and could become ugly. Hooker and Lyell, friends with authority, advise decency that doubles as prudence, present Wallace's paper and a short extract from Darwin's unpublished essay, written in 1844 and sequestered with a letter to Emma in case of the author's death, at the Linnean Society, publish without delay a short abstract of the larger book. Wallace consents with a generosity that historians will still admire. On July 1, 1858, the two papers are read in London to a room that takes little notice. In 1859, Darwin's abstract becomes On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, a title whose cadence reflects the century's habit of writing too long and whose content restores brevity to thought. The book is not a treatise in the Euclidean style. It is an argument with a memory for counterarguments. It begins with domestication, pigeons, dogs, cattle, because he knows his reader has seen these and trusted their reality. It moves to nature with a small bow to Malthus and a lingering gaze on variance. It introduces natural selection as the differential survival and reproduction of variants in a context of overproduction. It spends pages on difficulties, because a book that refuses to list its own worries is fragile. It ends with a paragraph that can make a stern reader unembarrassed to feel. He writes of a tangled bank, a small slope crowded with plants of many kinds, with birds that sing and insects that move, with worms that burrow, all dependent on each other in ways that make loops you cannot easily draw, and he says there is grandeur in this view of life. Diversity from descent, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful evolved. He does not ask you to sing. He shows you where the music is. The decades that follow are full, contentious, and sometimes comic because he can be modest and stubborn in the same hour. He writes the variation of animals and plants under domestication, thick and generous with cases. The descent of man, and selection in relation to sex, where he admits what his first book had only glanced at, that we are in the same genealogical web as other animals, that our minds and morals have ancestors and social instincts, that sexual selection, female choice, competition among males, ornaments and weapons that are not survival devices but courtship strategies, shapes plumage and antlers and
songs.
He writes the expression of the emotions in man and animals, borrowing from photography and his own children's faces and correspondence with missionaries and colonial administrators to argue that the smile, the sneer, the blush, the tears are old tools repurposed and refined, not tokens dropped into us entirely new. He writes books on orchids and self-fertilization, on cross-pollination and the advantage of mixing, on climbing plants that find supports with slow circles, on carnivorous plants that turn a leaf into a stomach, on the movement of plants in response to light and gravity. He writes about worms and soil and proves with simple experiments, tiles on lawns, crumbs of chalk placed on ground, that the earth's surface passes through a worm before it greets the boot. He paces his sand walk and thinks about inheritance and cannot make himself happy. He has the pattern, the fact of descent with modification, because his consilient evidence has made a scaffold too sturdy to push over. He has the mechanism of selection. He does not have the particulate mechanism of inheritance that will explain why traits do not simply blend into a featureless average. He proposes pangenesis, a hypothesis where all parts of the body throw off tiny gemmules that aggregate in the reproductive organs and carry information into the next generation. He knows it is a guess and says so. In a monastery garden in Moravia, Gregor Mendel is counting peas and writing a paper that will wait decades for readers. Darwin perhaps has the journal that carries it but does not read the piece. It is one of history's small accidents that cost years rather than ruining a life. His cousins and friends make a country science around him. Galton wants to make heredity a science and will make mischief with eugenics. Huxley fights bishops in courts real and theatrical and becomes Darwin's bulldog. Even when Darwin wishes the tone gentler, Gray in America writes sermons disguised as letters where he reconciles selection with providence for readers who want to keep both. Darwinian teleology, he calls it, a phrase that glows and puzzles. The so-called debate at Oxford is remembered for witty lines. The harder debates are in print, in classrooms, in laboratories, where a century's habit of seeing fixity must learn to enjoy flux. He receives letters in which people ask whether his view destroys meaning. He writes back with the patience of a good neighbor and says that a view of life that fits facts is not an enemy of meaning. For him, meaning lives well under law. He is asked whether he is an atheist. He writes that he has never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of God, that his view fluctuates, that he may be called by others an agnostic. He writes that he cannot pretend to ground morality in a physics of atoms alone, that the social instincts are enough to explain how sympathy, shame, and the desire for approval grow into conscience. He makes a religion out of work and kindness without calling it that. He sits with friends and drinks a little wine and tells stories about riding in the pampas with men who could sleep in saddles. He reads novels aloud in the evening because Emma likes them and because the day needs gentler endings than a page on calcareous worms can offer. He is criticized for missing a designer's evident hand in convergence, shapes that appear in marsupial and placental alike. He answers that similar circumstances favor similar solutions and that selection has few angles to work with when wings must be made from limbs. He is accused of making cruelty a law. He answers that struggle is a metaphor as much as a ledger term, and that struggle includes competition of seeds in a crowded patch of soil and sympathy in a troop. He is told that selection cannot produce novelty. He answers with pigeons whose skulls are so altered that one cannot believe they descend from rock doves until one breeds them. He answers with fancy fowl, with dogs, with cabbages and Brussels sprouts and cauliflowers, one species remodeled into many dishes. He is told that nature cannot make fine gradations. He answers with barnacles, where species bleed into varieties and varieties into species, and taxonomists fight bitterly about where to draw lines. He is told that he has left human dignity in ruins. He answers that the ruin was pride, not dignity, and that a dignity grounded in kinship is sturdier than one grounded in flattering stories. He knows suffering in his own house. Children die. One daughter, Annie, dies at 10 in 1851, and he writes that the keystone of his life fell. His own body is a country in revolt, heart pounding in ways a physician friend calls palpitations, vomiting that comes like weather, skin that breaks, eyes that burn, a nervous system that needs quiet more than society. The causes are guessed at and will be guessed at forever. Chagas disease from a bug's bite in South America, anxiety, Meniere's, a stomach with the soul of a barometer, the price of intensity paid in organs. He refuses to make a theater of his symptoms. He simply arranges his day around them and keeps walking. H.E. Gardens, he works with his children in small experiments because small hands are steady and because lessons learned together are cheaper than lectures. He writes in the margin of his life that he loves his wife and is lucky. The sentence is better than a theorem. His book changes not only science, but the tone in which we talk about ourselves. Before him, life looks like cabinets, species as drawers with labels, and nothing moving between them. After him, life looks like histories, lineages branching, going extinct, migrating, building, and losing. The past no longer seems behind glass. It is in the grain of our bodies, our languages, our myths. He dethrones humans from a climax position and puts us on a branch we share with apes, mice, weeds, and worms. He does not see this as diminishing. He sees it as an enlargement. To be kin with everything is not to be small. It is to be at home in a larger house. He also changes how we think about explanation. Purpose is replaced not with randomness, but with selection's conditional necessity. Natural selection is not a person. It is not a judge. It is a name for the algebra the world does when there is variation, heredity, and differential reproductive success. If one insists on teleology, it is teleology after the fact. The eye is for seeing because creatures with better seeing left more young, not because a plan was written and then bodies stitched to fit. After him, other minds will supply the pieces he wanted and could not find. Mendel's peas will be rediscovered in 1900 by de Vries, Correns, and Skirmack. Chromosomes will become more than threads. Genes will take their place as particulate carriers. Fisher, Haldane, and Wright will transform inheritance into equations and show that selection can move population means. Dobzhansky will show variation in the wild to be the raw stuff, not a lab fiction. Mayer, Simpson, and others will articulate speciation and macroevolution in a language Darwin would recognize and envy. The modern synthesis will carry the long argument across the 20th century. Molecular biologists will open DNA and find in its structure a mechanism for copying with errors in the right range, a recipe for variation and resemblance in a single molecule. Neutralists will remind selectionists that drift matters. Chance at the level of alleles can sculpt as well as chisel. Kin selection and inclusive fitness will widen the grammar of selfishness to include genes prospering through cousins. Later, evolutionary developmental biology will show that changes in the timing and intensity of gene expression, the regulation, can produce large morphological shifts, explaining why homologies stay while shapes vary. He would have loved these additions the way a builder loves better beams. But do not rush him into a coda where his work is complete without him. While he lives, he keeps asking new kinds of questions with the same insistence on apparatus and patience. He stares at plants that move so slowly we need time to sense it, and puts glass pins into stems and marks positions and weights and closes shutters to exclude light, and then admits light from one side and sees how hormones, unknown to him, speak without nerves. He watches animals that seem humble and finds them interesting. Earthworms that pull leaves into holes by the tip not at random but by preference, because a worm that learns which end goes in first keeps its doorway clear. He writes about small puzzles with the same gravity he brought to large arguments, because for him method is the dignity, not scale. He is criticized for encouraging materialism and the decline of hope. He does not recognize that version of hope. He writes near the end that he cannot see the universe as the outcome of chance, that the difference between man and the higher animals is great, that the difference is in degree, not kind, that there is grandeur in a world where, from a few forms or one, endless forms arise. He is asked whether he prays. He writes that, when sick, he cannot pretend. When well, he does not find himself compelled. He is ordinary in these admissions and kind. In 1882, at 73, he dies. He had wanted a quiet burial in the Down Parish. The nation insists and buries him in Westminster Abbey near Newton, a placing that caused some to wince and others to nod. It is fitting because the Abbey is a museum of ways of being important, and his way was to teach a country to be patient with time. The stone sits under feet. Tourists rest. Guides speak. A child asks whether Darwin and God are fighting under the floor. A docent smiles and says the Abbey is a place where fights end. The man would have liked the joke. His method is not mythic. It can be taught. It can be learned. It can be used tomorrow by a person with a notebook and an honest way of refusing to help a theory that wants to be right too soon. He had a habit of writing down not only what he found, but what he had expected and did not find. His notebooks are full of substitutions. I thought X, instead Y, a style of humility that keeps a mind from becoming a courtroom. He loved lists. He kept lists of pros and cons before asking Emma to marry him. He kept lists of arguments for and against publishing. He kept lists of questions to send to missionaries about whether dogs' expressions mean the same under other suns. The lists look fussy until you realize they are bridges across bias. Because we live in a present that needs reminders. Keep two sentences from his long argument where you can see them. The first is that explanation does not have to flatter us to be consoling. We are not the center. We are participants. Consolation that survives weather is better than flattery that fails at the first storm. The second is that small causes over long times are enough. You do not need catastrophes to make reefs. You need coral polyps and subsiding islands and patience. You do not need to posit perfect plans. You need variation and selection to draw the visible from the possible. The doctrine is not bleak. It is hopeful about the power of the ordinary. It is easy to borrow his metaphors and forget his discipline. He was not a slogan maker. He had a horror of cleverness without cases. He disagreed with friends on paper without ending friendships at table. He knew how to be silent until a sentence would help. He did not romanticize nature. He loved it and knew it could be cruel. He did not imagine that science would make men good. He hoped it would make them less credulous and therefore less easily used. He did not try to make his name a flag. He worked to make his method a habit. If you want to leave the room with a scene that keeps his style intact in your head, picture him kneeling on a lawn at dawn, lifting a tile he placed months ago, counting the castings of worms and measuring the depth of soil moved, smiling at the quiet arithmetic the earth performs under our feet. The revolution is in that posture. He is not on a stage. He is on grass. He is not intoning. He is measuring. He is not asking the world to flatter a theory. He is asking it to say what it did last night. He closes his notebook and goes inside to write, then to rest, then to read Emma a page from a novel that will not give him indigestion. He is not heroic in the way a painting likes. He is heroic in the way a culture needs. You have been listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed Our Understanding of the World We Live In. Today we stood in a study where string keeps papers from escaping, walked a path packed firm by worry and relief, crossed cages full of pigeons and drawers full of barnacles, and watched a man transform patience into a theory that made life continuous where it had been filed. In our next episode, we will open a friar's garden notebook in a monastery where peas knock quietly on the door of arithmetic and watch Gregor Mendel count the green and the yellow until inheritance becomes a series and blending gives way to units you can track so that Darwin's long argument gets its missing mechanism. Until then, thank you for your attention and your time. This episode was written as a continuous story for the year. If it moved you, bring a friend along next time. Until our next hour together, keep an eye on the small differences you lean on. They are closer than they look.